On today's College Football Inquirer, it's not Ross Dellinger's Congressional Minute. It might be Ross Dellinger's Congressional Hour, because there is a bipartisan bill in the Senate aimed at fixing college sports. Did it? Will it? We'll talk about it. This is the College Football Inquirer with Ross Dellinger. I'm Andy Staples. We're in lovely, I think officially Miramar Beach, Florida. Destin, we're in the Redneck Riviera. SEC spring meetings going on, and we were here yesterday, and all of the SEC's athletic directors and coaches were in a meeting when, from Washington, D.C., it dropped the Ted Cruz, Maria Cantwell bipartisan bill in the Senate addressing college sports. What's our cute little name for this bill here?
The Protect College Sports Act.
Ah, okay.
Is the name.
I can't keep track of the names.
It was interestingly timed. You know, they've been working on this for more than 2 months, and they've been meeting daily, Cantwell and Cruz, for better part of 2 weeks. And so finally they came to an agreement and decided to announce, right when the meetings were happening with AD coaches. And then on the other side, Greg Sankey had just walked into his meeting with university presidents as well.
Yeah.
Right when it dropped. So the agenda changed a bit. I think Sankey and others knew mostly what was in the bill, but you don't know exactly until the language comes out, which really came out after it was announced. And a lot of people haven't gotten a chance to even now read the full 111 pages.
Yeah, it's a lot to digest. And it's funny because usually I kind of blow people off when they get up in a press conference and say, well, I haven't had a chance to look at it. Like Greg Sankey, when he talked to us yesterday afternoon, had really not had a chance to read it. He'd been in meetings all day. It's thick. We were all sitting there, you know, all the reporters who gathered this, just sitting there scrolling down the bill at lunch. Yeah. And there's so much here, we can do bullet points. Mm. So
yeah,
definitely not. Nobody's getting everything they want. Let's put it that way. Which is to be expected with a bipartisan bill, but they basically they want to keep the revenue cap kind of as is, want to enshrine the House settlement as law. So that's the revenue part of it. They want to have 5 years to play five, one free undergraduate transfer. I'm not clear on whether you can transfer as a grad.
I think it would continue to like align with the NCAA rules of a second transfer.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I guess the big ones that the SEC, Big Ten, and other conferences wanted, they got all those, where your transfer limitation, one-time transfer eligibility, the cap, but the NIL, the agent registry, the fees, the capping the fees of the agents. But then there's all the other stuff.
Right. And okay. So Senator Cantwell told you that there'd be a mechanism for the players to push for the cap to be raised, which I found interesting.
Yeah.
I think poor man's collective bargaining.
Yeah. In a way, if the players were to unionize and get together in some way and sort of argue for the cap to be raised. And, you know, that was interesting. So let's break down that part of it, because that's probably the one that everybody's like, well, hold on. It's going to set a hard cap, because we have a soft cap now, obviously, and people are going well way over it. So how does that happen, and how do you get enough votes in the Senate from Democrats if you're going to take money away
from athletes?
I thought, you know, I asked her that, and that's where she responded with the, well, there's language in the bill to have them raise the revenue share cap, so you don't have all this outside.
She essentially created a path to employment and collective bargaining, which is interesting, because Cruz's whole thing for most of this time was they're not employees.
Right.
They wanted to put in the bill they're not employees. Yeah. That didn't happen. So again, everybody doesn't get what they want, and that's usually how you get something passed. Mm-hmm. But I want to talk about the thing that made the most waves here, and I'm sure in Big Ten country as well, and that is the part about the broadcast rights and the numbers, because this was very cleverly written. If you are a certain person who might have played offensive line at Texas Tech and made billions of dollars in the oil business.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. Now, one thing I want to go back, Andy, and just say, people are probably listening of like, well, how do they even do a hard cap? You know, and it's a good question, because we're supposed to have a hard cap now. We don't. And it basically, this bill, bottom line, is like the one sentence explanation is it gives antitrust and legal protection for Brian Seeley and the CSC.
Right. You could actually punish. You could actually. And their punishments would be removing dollars from the cap for next year, you know, they can't take draft picks like the NFL does.
Yeah.
That's their big punishment. Right. So the big stick would be, we take millions out of your cap. Now, I have my doubts on whether anything would actually change in terms of whether it would actually act like a hard cap. I don't think it would, because it doesn't now. Yeah. But the TV stuff is much more interesting.
Yeah,
it's why I think it's at, if you're a college football fan who likes the you know, pageantry and the variety of college football, and likes that there's, you know, 138 schools now in the FBS, and you like that, you'll like this part. If you are an SEC or Big Ten president or athletic director, you don't like this part because it feels like you're being forced in a direction that you don't want to go.
Right. Yeah, and there's a few things, two main ones, I guess, in the bill that sort of, like you might say, targets the SEC and Big Ten.
Yeah.
It's the Sports Broadcasting Act, which we can get to the details in a minute. And then it's the precluding mergers of a Super League and expansion of the SEC and Big Ten, specifically the SEC and Big Ten, right?
Yes.
It targets those two leagues.
Yes.
So let's get to both of those. Like, the creation of another, it's basically a replica of the Sports Broadcasting Act that protects professional sports from it enables them to collude,
right, and sell their TV rights as one. Yeah. Rights.
Yeah. And so this would be the college sports version of that. Mm-hmm. Hey, all the conferences can collude, sell their media rights. And the theory is they'll get 2-3, some people even say 4 times the amount of money.
I've talked to those others people. I'm a little skeptical on that number.
Right. Others, including in this league, say it's not that high. It is more.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's probably, like, the lowest estimates are, it probably would be like 30 to 40%.
Yes. I'd say 1.5 to 2 times what they make now, depending on how things go. But
right.
it, there's a lot more money in the system to be made, because it would create a legal monopoly like the NFL and Major League Baseball and the NBA have. And that's, you know, these guys want more revenue. That's more revenue.
Yeah.
But these guys in particular, we're here with the SEC people, they don't want it that way.
Well, they're going to, right. And they're going to get more revenue no matter what.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Their TV deal and the Big Ten TV deal, a part of a reason they're against the pooling of rights is their amounts annually are going up or skyrocketing. And that gap between the Big Ten, SEC, and everybody else is growing because of that.
Yeah.
And everybody else is trying to close that gap. Mm-hmm. And so once, hey, we could pool the rights and we could probably take some of the value from the SEC and Big Ten and sort of distribute it more evenly.
Yep.
And of course, the SEC and Big Ten want to keep their value, want to keep their money. And so they're fighting.
Well, they want to keep their power, because the way this would work if it happened, the SEC and the Big Ten would make significantly more money than everybody else still. The gap the money gap might not be quite as wide. The power gap would definitely not be as wide, because the Big Ten and the SEC, to make this happen, to make themselves more money, would need the other league's participation in this. And let's talk about the numbers, because I'm terrible at math. And so I had my friend Pete Nakos from On3. He's the one breaking it down for me, because he saw it immediately. He pulled the bill open.
The reason that number was made.
He pulled the bill open and he goes, oh my, I saw him turn the calculator on his phone. Hmm. He's like, oh my God. Yeah. So 75% of the schools in the FBS have to want to participate in this thing. So
to trigger the antitrust exemption to let them collude.
Yes. Now, I think they were starting to do this before Sac State and North Dakota State joined. So it was 136, then it's 138 now. 75% of 138 is 103.5. So 104 would be your magic number. Mm-hmm. What is 138 minus the membership of the SEC and the Big Ten?
Mm-hmm.
It is 104.
Yeah.
So Notre Dame fans have been quick to say, but would Notre Dame want to do this? You guys don't understand. This is not Notre Dame having to join a conference.
Right.
This would be Notre Dame pooling TV rights and just taking more money.
Yeah. And so, Notre Dame was sort of, I wrote it in a story last night, like Notre Dame was the swing vote in a way, because we know the Big Ten and SEC are opposed to this. But we know, as I wrote in my story, like Pete Bavacqua has said publicly a few times that he is not in favor of the pooling of rights, nor would any big brand. We just talked about the value of being a big brand.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to pool with everybody else, because it probably means you're going to diminish the amount of money going to you.
Yeah.
So Notre Dame, of course, would be in the same bucket as the Big Ten and SEC. So basically, to boil it down, right, the Big Ten, SEC, and Notre Dame can stop the pooling of rights from happening. And, but they wouldn't have to join if
the other ones
they came over.
But if the other ones wanted to all do it, they
couldn't do it.
They could without Notre Dame.
Right. Or an increase in FBS membership, although I don't know the particulars around.
Oh, I
that around.
Man, if I'm the Mac, I take a couple more teams real quick.
Yeah. But I don't know that the pooling of everybody else would matter, right? I don't know that it would increase.
I don't, it's not necessarily worth that much. It would probably allow them to some more flexibility to schedule and sell. And
maybe
it'd actually be more practical than
right
in terms of just giant, it wouldn't be a giant revenue.
Which is what I asked Ted Cruz about this when 2 days ago before on the lead up to the bill announcement is what if the Big Ten and SEC don't agree to pool their rights? And he said, well, then the money's not going to work out.
Yeah.
So they need everybody to do it. He knows that. They all know they need everybody to sort of be a part of this. And so, of course, my follow-up was, well, how do you get them to be a part of it? And the easy answer is, we'd just like the CFP negotiations. You negotiate out a deal that's beneficial for the SEC to do this.
The part of this I think a lot of people don't understand is it doesn't require them to share the money equally.
Yeah.
They would all be negotiated. Like,
yeah.
So the SEC would get, it, theoretically, if they did this, the SEC would get a certain amount, the Big Ten would get a certain, Notre Dame would get a certain amount, and none of them signing on unless that amount hits the number they want. Producer TJ asked a good question, Ross. Like, could the other ones, if they wanted to do it, force the SEC and the Big Ten into it? I think that is why it's written the way it's written, because if the other ones decided to do it, the SEC and the Big Ten at that point would be leaving money on the table for themselves by not doing it.
Yeah.
And I don't know that they, in this environment, that they would allow themselves to leave money on the table.
No. They're not, in this financially sort of stressed time where everybody's looking for a dime, I would imagine that they would not do that. And then there's the other part of the bill.
Right.
Right, Andy, with
the targeting.
The targeting.
Nothing to do with helmet-to-helmet contact.
But. Yeah. No, prohibiting the Super League, a merger, prohibiting expansion as well. So the membership would have to sort of stay the same.
And that's, you can't just grab Clemson and North Carolina and say, well, now we have our numbers.
Right.
We can block anything.
Right,
so.
Right. Now, we could probably get to the part of this of, is any of this going to happen? You know, it's a long road, right? They'll probably have a hearing next week, either Wednesday or Thursday in the Senate. And that's like step two in the process. And step three will probably be another hearing or another, if not a hearing, a committee meeting
right.
to potentially do a vote and mark what they call mark up the bill and amend it.
Yeah.
And then there'll be maybe a final product that gets to the Senate floor. So this is a weeks, months long process just to get to the Senate floor before you get to a vote and before it goes to the House. So a lot has to happen to get.
This is the most likely way to pass one. If you have a bipartisan bill coming out of the Senate, it's still unlikely.
Yeah.
And now when you have what Ross and I just described with this is a bill I don't think the SEC and the Big Ten are going to fully support.
I would say that's accurate. Yep.
And I think without their full support, it's not happening.
I think there would need to be plenty of amendments to get their full support, including about the mergers and the expansion language, and even to a degree, maybe the SBA language as well. It is funny when you talk to administrators at certain schools, when they first hear sort of a summary of the bill. Sure, they don't like a couple of the things that we've talked about, but many of them seem to want to say that, hey, this is a good compromise.
What are you willing to live with?
Right.
Yeah.
And because you get everything else in the bill, you asked for and you've gotten. So you got to deal with all this other stuff, one of which is just an option, the other of which is just like a prohibition. So I think if Cody Campbell said it in the presidential roundtable back in February is, if we're going to get a bill, we know it's a good bill when everybody's mad. And it does seem like both sides here are
well, and you had player advocates that were mad about it.
There was a call last night with Marie Cantwell and members of the Urban League, I believe, in some other players association people about critical of the bill. Critical of how it gives the NCAA antitrust exemption for all these things, basically collectively bargains for the athletes with some of this stuff.
Right.
And so she heard an earful last night, and that will, but I'm sure that will continue.
You mentioned Cody Campbell, and I think he's an important name to bring up in this. So we talk about him a lot and for a lot of different reasons, but former Texas Tech offensive lineman, chair of the Texas Tech board, oil billionaire, his mission has been to make sure Texas Tech is not left out of whatever club forms. And that's why I had a friend from Texas A&M text me after the bill came out and said, did Ted Cruz let Cody Campbell write the bill? And so the SBA part of it is definitely that group's baby.
And, I think there's there's many people that, and Greg Sinke kind of hinted at this yesterday with us. There's certainly many people involved in the crafting of developing of legislation that are outside of the congressional halls. And I think this includes Cody. This includes Randy Levine, Yankees president, who's heading some of the presidential committees. And this includes Jack Swarbrick, former Notre Dame athletic director, who's working for Smash Sports. It's a private capital.
They've been circling around this for a while.
They have a couple of lobbyists they've hired on the Hill, and they are, and all these people want different things, right? I mean, I think the Smash folks and Jack Swarbrick have been arguing for a long time that the consolidation of rights needs to happen. They're very pro rights. Cody Campbell obviously did advertisements for that right during the fall. Mm-hmm. Randy Levine, not so much. I don't think that he's necessarily full throttle on the rights, but all these people had a little bit of a hand, I think, in this. And to me, in general, the bill reads as if it's pretty clear. And Maria Cantwell said it to me flatly, is they're trying to close the financial gap between the SEC, Big Ten, and everybody else.
Which obviously for the SEC and the Big Ten, you don't want. And it's interesting because the SEC and the Big Ten have poured millions of dollars into lobbying. They've been lobbying for several years at this point. And Greg Sankey, said it yesterday, and I asked the question. I said, I started to ask the question. Mm. Let me finish. I said, when you ask Congress for help, and he stopped me right there, and he said, you never know when you're going to get.
Yeah.
And
that's right. I remember after the SCORE Act died a couple of weeks ago, wrote a column for you guys for On3 about going. I went back to and I caught the quote from I think it was John Kennedy, the senator out of Louisiana, in one of the first college sports hearings, like 4 years ago or so. John Kennedy said something to the effect of, "I don't think you want us to help."
Right.
And I think
Greg Sankey referenced the famous quote, Ronald Reagan quote. Yeah,
Reagan quote of. I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Yeah.
First nine words
in the English language.
Nobody wants to hear. So you got to take the good with the bad. And I think that actually the fact that both sides are angry in this, you have Players Association people and that don't align with many SEC Big Ten people. And both of these groups are sort of, in a way, frustrated and angry about the bill, the SEC and Big Ten, because they feel sort of targeted in a way, and then the Players Association side, because they feel like this was a collectively bargained agreement that didn't involve the players enough and takes away freedom in compensation from the players.
And whether it does or not, it would depend on how it's actually administered. But to your point, and you mentioned the clock that it's ticking. Mm. The other piece of this, and we're not going to get super political here on the show, but midterm elections are coming up.
Yeah.
That is a reality. And once this Congress goes to recess, it is all midterm elections for all of those people until the elections.
So you don't want to get political. Oh, we don't have Godfrey here.
Yeah.
So we can't get too political without him.
But that's the political reality of this. Yeah. And then the makeup of Congress might look different after the midterm elections. Almost certainly.
The expectation is that it will, right? So you have a timeline here that you probably need to get something through the Senate before the August recess. Maybe you even need to get through both chambers before the August recess, because as you mentioned, after the August recess, you're in
everybody in the House is up for election.
Yeah,
so
you're in the heart of campaign season. It's going to be difficult, and right now the projections show that the House will flip. And so if you're not going to get probably not going to get a Democratic House to vote for any kind of bill that looks like the SCORE Act or even looks like this Senate bill. It's going to be difficult. So your time to do this is it's a very short window.
So that's a long way of saying we've said this probably won't happen, that they probably won't be able to get a law passed. We were saying, I was saying that before for a different reason, because I honestly didn't think they'd come to a compromise like this. I thought they'd never get there. They did get there.
Yeah.
Now I think it's because they pissed off the wrong people and they're probably not going to be able to get it through.
Yeah. When you look at, they need 60 votes in the Senate, obviously. And so that means about 7 Democrats have to vote for it. And you obviously have one.
Right.
You have two, Marie Cantwell and Chris Coons, who are both Democrats who are on board. So you're looking at 5. And that's going to be difficult, but really the biggest hurdle may actually be in the House, where you've got 3 to 5, you have a very small margin, a majority, and in the House you don't have to get to 6, or you don't.
Yeah,
to
you just a simple majority. Yeah,
the simple majority will work, but there's only 3. The Republicans only have a 3 vote advantage,
right? And if somebody in one state feels particularly aggrieved, you have a problem.
That's right.
So that's a long way of saying what I've been saying all along. Maybe they should solve their problems themselves.
Mm.
Ross, you have written about
Plan B,
how the league we're meeting with here might actually be attempting to solve its problems itself. Let's talk about it when we come back. We are back to College Football Inquirer, and Ross, you wrote this week about something that I think if you'd have written it 5 years ago, half the people you talked to about it would have said you were insane for even bringing it up.
Yeah,
and now they are starting to come around on the idea that in the SEC even, that maybe collective bargaining might be the way to solve some of these problems.
Yeah, there's really 2 pathways to avoiding legal challenges and putting restrictions on athletes, right? One is the congressional bill we just talked about, and the other one is collective bargaining. That's really it, right?
Right, and one of them has been demonstrated to be very effective.
Yes, yeah,
that's by other leagues,
professional level.
Yeah,
we see it all the time. So there was a presentations, and there have been the last couple weeks with some folks at the high level positions of the SEC on collective bargaining, what a framework of bargaining will look like. Are they anywhere close to pulling the trigger on collective bargaining? No, right? Not at all. But the fact that they're taking a peek at it, especially at a meeting such as this with the whole room,
the president's
watching
here,
a presentation. Yeah. The president's sitting in a room. I don't think the athletic directors were invited in. Mm. The coaches were certainly not invited in.
What's funny is the coaches want it.
Many of the AD's, right? I think that's right. That's the funny part is the ironic part is the people who are probably most for it, the coaches and many of the
AD's. But the coaches all have friends in the NFL who tell them, we have these rules and we can actually enforce them.
Yeah.
And all the college coaches are like, man, I want some of that. How do I do that?
Too, all these coaches and AD's are sort of thinking along the lines of they're practitioners on the ground, a lot of them, right? So they're like dealing with the first-hand issues with not having rules that are agreed to by the players. And university presidents aren't as much. Now, they're starting to get more involved, and they're certainly starting to see the bottom line of the cost.
Right.
And I think that is what has probably got a lot of them around to, we need to at least look at this.
Yeah.
And credit to Greg Sankey in the league, and Dondi Plowman, the Tennessee chancellor, is the chair of the board, and she was a big hand in some of these presentations, too, of showing this is what it will look like. So they're at least looking at it.
Interestingly enough, Dondi Plowman's AD, Danny White, was the first of these guys to publicly say, hey, we got to collectively bargain. I believe in a Ross Stellinger story.
Yeah, last year, right at this time. He in fact, at this event, I got the presentation that Danny White has for bargaining with athletes. So they're at least looking at that. Now, Andy, we didn't talk about the third path, which isn't really the greatest path of having some kind of rules and regulations without getting sued, because I think you'd still get sued. But they're also talking about that path, which is the self-governance, right?
Yes.
It's breaking away sort of in governing yourself, creating your own rules and enforcement. You know, does it mean leaving completely and breaking away from the NCAA? Probably not, but it is at least a portion, or described to me as a portion of breaking away when it comes to establishing different rules and enforcing them. So, we're seeing the presidents who are meeting right now as we're talking about this, yes. I believe. We're seeing them go down this road of here's the 4, 6, 8 items that we may establish our own rules on and enforce them. And we're just going to hope that everybody else does the same in order to have a sort of equal competitive market.
Right. And history tells you that's probably not how that's going to go, because that the history of college sports is littered with things like this. I'll give you an example. Back in the day, Barry Switzer at Oklahoma used to feast, because Oklahoma was in the Big Eight. Obviously, Oklahoma's big rival is Texas. They were in the Southwest Conference. But Oklahoma recruited in a lot of the same areas as most of the Southwest Conference schools. So what Oklahoma would do is the Southwest Conference had a signing day that was before the Big Eight's signing day. And they would wait until players signed with Southwest Conference schools, and they would just go pick off, TCU signed somebody we like, Rice signed somebody we like, SMU signed somebody we like, and they just grab them. And that's why they tried to move to a more nationalized set of rules, not just because of that, but because of a lot of different issues. Ross, I think we've seen this with everybody involved since NIL started. Everybody will seek the competitive advantage they can find the fastest. And
they will. They will. Even somehow within the league, if they create their own rules, there'll be people trying to find loopholes. And that's why, at least nationally, the issues you might run into nationally where there's inequity in the rules and the enforcement is why you see people like Jerry Moorhead, the Georgia president, and others saying, well, why don't we just compete against ourselves?
Yeah.
Which, you've heard in the SEC, and Andy's been...
You want to devalue TV rights, that'll do it real quick.
Yeah, that could be an issue in a lot of ways. But I think people in the league are looking at the cost and saying, how can we get down the cost if we don't get a congressional bill and if we don't strike some kind of collective bargaining agreement? How can we get the cost down? And part of that is, well, we'll just establish our own rules and have a better, stricter enforcement.
Which, if I were the Big Ten, which is now making more money than the SEC, I would immediately look at what rules the SEC created and create rules that allowed me to pay a little bit more.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. That is exactly what will happen. That CBA is the one thing that would be, it's not lawsuit proof, but it is pretty close.
Yeah.
Where you could have like the NFL and the NBA have hard salary caps.
Yeah.
The NBA has a luxury tax that you can do, but the NFL is like a purely hard salary cap, and that isn't challenged. Now, the next time the CBA is up, there will be strife.
Yeah.
But I don't think the NFL is going to have a work stoppage, because there's too much money rolling in for everybody. They'll figure it out.
And people listening probably are asking, well, why don't they just do this? And it's a good question, but it is really complicated. There are plenty of issues. One, you're tied to higher education institution. Mm-hmm. Let's just start there.
Well, good example. So there's a school here, University of South Carolina. Their employees are not allowed to collectively bargain.
Right. You have state laws.
Yeah.
You have politicians who certainly would not agree in any way. You have state laws against bargaining, I believe, against state employees bargaining. So you'd have to, and Danny White's presentation gets around some of this by establishing a neutral entity where athletes are employees.
Employees at the conference. There's ways to do it.
It gets complicated. Then there are benefits that a state or university or conference would have to pay on top of salaries and compensation. So you're not only talking about the compensation, but you're talking about as much as 50-70% more in benefits. So it just really gets, and then you got the possibility of, when it comes open, a strike or a work stoppage, and you've got all these things that just changes a lot.
But that possibility exists now. I
Oh, yeah, we're getting to the point where they're, because of the deals, right? Mm-hmm. We've talked about this a lot. I've written about it a lot. Like, millions and millions of deals are caught in the College Sports Commission system right now. And if they're not approved, players will potentially not at least legally get paid. And that that can present some problems.
Yeah. And so I think everybody holds that out as the boogeyman. But that's been a threat. And it's funny because even before the players were getting paid, it was a threat. There have been times when people have, different groups have tried to get basketball teams playing the NCAA tournament to sit. And so it's not like that isn't just hanging there over their heads anyway.
Right.
So I don't think if you had collective bargaining, that wouldn't be that big of a difference.
And then another thing, obviously, is who do you bargain with exactly, right? Is there a players association? There are some that have popped up.
Well, and you and I both know that various unions have been racing to be the winds up backing the players association.
Right. And then what sport do you
employ? There's money to be made in all of this, guys. Just remember that. And if somebody's trying to cash in on every side of every angle of this.
And Greg Sankey always brings up the point of, are you bargaining with just a few sports, and if you're not bargaining with all the others, what does that mean for them? What does that mean legally for them as far as challenges and lawsuits and all that stuff? So it does get really complicated.
Yeah, I talked to an AD about this probably about a year ago, and the way they put it was pretty simple. You bargain with the sports that make money.
Yeah.
And the other sports, you tell them, hey, you can have a scholarship, or and you can do real NIL, or you can opt in to revenue sharing, and we'll send you a bill every semester.
Yeah.
And most people would probably accept the scholarship at that point.
That's Tennessee's right plan, is just the revenue generating sports, mainly football and men's basketball would be the bargaining units. But again, going back to some comments that Sankey has made is, well, at LSU you have baseball, that's a generating sport. What do you do with that? Kentucky, certainly. Well, that's men's basketball, as I've mentioned. But Nebraska, volleyball. Revenue generating sport.
Gymnastics at a lot of the SEC schools.
Alabama, gymnastics, even LSU gymnastics. Yep. So, yeah, there are certainly issues with and complications with the bargaining, which is why.
But I would say figure out football and basketball, and most of your problems are
solved, right? 90% of your problems are solved. But all the complications lead me to say that it is a positive for many people that they're looking at bargaining presentations, but don't expect them to jump at anything. And in fact, I think the bargaining presentation, or presentations, plural, whatever it was that the president saw on Wednesday, I don't think is something they're going to jump into anytime soon.
I think they're being forced that way. Either direction you've talked about, whether it's the bargaining or whether it's the self-governance, they both are fraught with different issues, but they are not going to have another choice, because if this bill does not pass, and I'm not sure the people upstairs from us even want it to at this point, they will have to figure something out. Or As the godfather of this pod, Dan Wetzel, often says, they could just let it go like it is now.
Where
everybody's making money. So.
They could. I think the other side of that, as you've heard, is there are issues in there too, especially for
Greg Byrne from Alabama talking about how basketball, because they're paying the players so much, is now becoming a revenue loser. To it, or it's not a profit generator anymore. It's now in the red where it used to be in the black.
Well, you look at that, was in my collective bargaining story too. If you break down the numbers,
to which I'd say, and I did say this to Greg, how about you just don't then?
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Yes. And then of course many of their answers as well. If I don't win, I get fired. So
but you get a buyout. So
you
enjoy it.
But it is interesting. And I think it's a reason why the university presidents here, who have the group has been so long pushed back against bargaining, why they're looking at it is because when you do the math and you take the revenue from each football program in the SEC and you look at what they're paying their roster, a lot of them are at or over the 50% mark,
right?
Right.
Which is more than like 50% is what an NFL,
right?
What the NFL does,
and they're definitely over 50 with basketball. To Greg's point,
correct,
right?
Correct.
Almost all of them are over 50 in basketball.
I'm flipping about it, where I say, you know, do it, run it like any other business. Where if you don't have the money, you don't pay it. But there is a competitive aspect to this. There's a scoreboard every day. There are games, and they do get fired. So the CBA is probably the method you'd need to save them from themselves,
right?
Because they wouldn't stop. Because it would be, we have to get this next guy or we're all getting fired.
Right. Well, in the self-governance, right, and them agreeing to all these rules together is another way of save us from ourselves.
Well, yeah.
We have to stop spending, even if it means not spending against or playing against those in the national landscape. So we'll see what comes of today. When you're watching or listening to this, we'll know a little more. Probably not a lot. I don't expect any crazy decisions,
revelations, or any bold statements on the bill either.
No, probably not. Right, probably not. Even if Greg Sankey and them have read it, I don't expect some kind of like strict announced position.
Right,
anybody's going to take.
Yeah, it's also fairly nuanced. This is the sort of thing you're going to need a few days to cook up your position on this. Ross, the complaining is not limited to the halls of Congress, the meeting rooms. It's also on the field.
Yeah.
We got kickoff times. You know we love kickoff times. You know
who used to be the old thing we waited for?
Oh, here. Yeah. We'd sit there.
There's so much other stuff.
They'd hand it out on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
So kickoff times from all the power leagues came out on Wednesday, and one particular athletic director was not happy and made his displeasure known. And it's a spicy topic here. We'll talk about it when we come back. We are back at College Football Inquirer, and it is time to head closer to the field. We got some kickoff times, and Ross, before we get into the kerfuffle that happened at the SEC meetings with regard to some SEC kickoff times, we did get an answer to a question that we've been asking for months on this show. With the fairly horrendous week one schedule, what will be Big Noon kickoff on Fox week one? And we have our answer. North Texas at Indiana. Let's bring the traveling road show to Bloomington for the North Texas game.
Woohoo! All right.
I don't know if they're planning to do the full Megillah on that game. We'll see. We might have to do that from the studio in LA. But that is the game that will be broadcast at noon, week one on Fox.
They would have moved, and we talked about this, right?
Yeah.
Moving up, trying to move up a game
to
fill that slot. It's crazy that the Big Ten couldn't, or the Fox, whoever, couldn't come to some agreement to put a better game.
Yeah, it's
not that I say, I mean, the Mean Green, last year's Mean Green team,
right? If Eric Morris and Drew Messemaker are still there,
everybody's gone.
No offense, and no offense intended to Neil Brown. I'm sure he's going to do great there.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just they are very much in a rebuild. And they're going to go play the defending national champions and probably get smashed.
Yeah.
So that is one. But we've talked enough about how bad the Big Ten schedule is week one. Let's get to the SEC week two and week three schedule, because that is what Arkansas athletic director Hunter Yurecek had the biggest problem with. So Arkansas going to Utah to play, which is going to be a fun game. That's Ryan Silverfield, the new head coach at Arkansas. You've got Morgan Scalley taking over at Utah after that very odd and strange transition of power there.
Yeah.
And so Hunter Yurecek put out a statement saying, hey, you're costing our young men a day of recovery. And so basically,
the time.
Yeah, they're right. The kickoff time. So they're kicking off this Utah game. It'll be about 9:15 Eastern time.
Yeah.
And it'll be about 7 o'clock local time in Utah.
Mm.
And then Arkansas comes back home and they play the next week against Georgia and they play the earliest possible kick. They play an 11 a.m. local kickoff against Georgia. And so Hunter Yurecek very displeased with this. Now, we asked Greg Sankey about this and it was not the response I thought
we get.
Yeah. He said that the league office actually did step in on Arkansas's behalf. And both these games are ESPN games, by the way. The Arkansas-Utah is on ABC. The Georgia and Arkansas game is on ESPN. So these are both Disney-owned networks. This is not a case where Fox picked a game time for a Big 12 site and then ESPN. This is ESPN's choice.
Yeah.
And so the SEC stepped in with its sole league partner and said, hey, we'd prefer if you didn't do it this way. And ESPN's like, we pay you lots of money, and we're going to decide when the games kick off.
Yeah, we'll consider your opinion.
Yeah.
And form a committee to come up with the solution that we already, or the answer that we already had found. This has been an issue for years and years, but I feel like it's become, well, first of all, society has changed in a way where we're seeing administrators, coaches say things publicly they used to not.
Right.
I think that's just indicative of American society in general and the culture and where it's gone. So we're seeing more, you got that. But then also, Andy, you have what we talk about often on the show, which is the evolution of college athletics becoming more of this big money industry where you need to win games to make money to now pay players. And I think there's just more pressure on everybody.
Yeah.
And I think when you're an AD like Hunter and you see that your team is going to have less rest, then I think that, you know, you feel like that puts you at a disadvantage to vocalize it.
Yeah. As you point out, this isn't new. Like in the old Pac-12, that it was almost a joke where you would look, oh, who's playing? Who's got a Friday night game in Pullman?
Yeah.
And you just circle that and go, the road team's losing that game. And inevitably you'd look, and the team that is playing the Friday night game in Pullman, if you look at their previous game, it would be the latest possible kick at home. So they would have the shortest possible time and have to go to Pullman, and they just what Mike Leach feasted on those teams.
Yeah.
And so and the ADs, you know, you'd hear from them every year. I can't believe the league is doing this to us.
Yeah.
But it's not the league, it's TV.
And we see that in the Big Ten now because it goes coast to coast into the Big 12 and ACC too, right? We see this happen a decent amount. But again, you know, nobody forced Arkansas to play at Utah.
Yep.
And nobody forced these.
Although we're glad they
big enough.
We as a podcast are glad they're scheduling good non-conference games.
That is.
I want to point that out.
That is, especially when we're seeing them get canceled so much because all these leagues are going to 9 conference games or 10, right?
Yes.
We see a lot of talk of 10 conference games. Not necessarily here as much. The Big Ten talked about it. The Big 12, I think, is talking about it too. Again, it's all an effort to, I think, generate more money and interest. Mm-hmm. Just playing more conference games and less small FCS.
Yeah, well, it's they want to schedule more conference games because teams will not on their own schedule good non-conference games.
Yeah.
And that's my biggest source of frustration with the whole playoff debate. There's a reason we haven't really gotten into the playoff debate here this week, even though that's something a lot of people have talked about, is there's nothing to it other than
there's nothing really new.
If
I mean, it's just not.
They need to figure out a way to incentivize hard scheduling to make people schedule good. Like, you want to protect the regular season? Don't worry about the field size of the playoff.
Yeah.
You protect the regular season by having people schedule good games.
Well, and we it's funny because we're seeing, you know, the SEC increased it to 9. They're scheduled 9 games, and so thus we're seeing SEC schools cancel all these Power 4 non-conference games that they've previously scheduled. So you're sort of losing a good non-conference matchup and gaining a conference matchup. That's what we've seen happening,
and you're screwing your conference partners.
Yeah,
because or your TV partners in that way, and that's why the TV partners are not that sad about screwing you on kickoff times. And you know, it's interesting. Somebody asked, I believe it was Ben Portnoy from Sports Business Journal, asked Greg Sankey, does he feel like the SEC's deal with ESPN currently is undervalued? And Greg Sankey very bluntly said yes. And then he expanded on that and said, I would rather over-deliver than under-deliver. He may as well have pointed north when he said that.
Yeah.
Because the Big Ten not delivering on its its TV deal at the moment.
He's getting, I guess the numbers are, I can't remember the number, like 200 million less, 300 million less.
Yeah.
Somewhere around there than the Big Ten. I think the SEC is behind in that category. when probably viewership wise it should be ahead. We learned yesterday 36% of college football viewership,
yeah,
right, was the SEC, was, yeah, I don't know if that was the SEC regular season and championship game combined. We didn't get the exact details of that, but
yeah, and if you just look at a list of games, you know, obviously, like, you know, Ohio State, Michigan's still going to be up there in usually number one or number two depending on the year, but it's mostly SEC games, and right. they did a good job. The thing they've done since they started the all in deal with ESPN versus having the best game of the week on CBS before is that triple header that they do a lot of weekends on ABC, where yeah. it's three SEC yeah. games in a row. The storylines kind of feed into one another, and people right. will just leave that
yeah.
channel on.
Yeah.
They won't change the channel.
Yeah. There is something too to Andy, actually, it's in the to wrap up yeah. our pod by talking about
the bill
beginning in our pod, yeah. the regionalization in the bill. In the bill, there's a encouragement with the Sports Broadcasting Act stuff in the Senate bill that encourages not just a regionalization, but hey, maybe you could just reorganize your conferences based on regional, like you used to have them.
Yeah.
And so it kind of gets back to like, hey, the SEC, part of the SEC sort of brand is we are still one of the few, maybe, and probably the only power conference that is a sort of regional.
It's geographically contiguous.
Yeah,
it's regional.
11
yeah.
states all touch one another.
Yeah.
Even though there's obviously far, yeah. you know, there. I mean, going from Austin,
Missouri,
Texas,
and Florida are a long
South
way.
South Carolina yeah. are yeah. pretty far. Yeah, yeah, the other way, that way. So, but they're all touching.
Yep.
And culturally, mostly, except for maybe a couple outliers, culturally, they all pretty much align. And, you know, we don't see that in any other power league. It's
no.
just not there. And I think that's part of why the viewership is the way it is in the SEC.
Right, because it is more of a cultural thing and you know, people understand it. And again, I think they do the other piece of it that they won't say. Hmm. Closest margin of victory within the league games
yeah.
of any year this century, I believe.
Yeah, right. What was it? Do you remember?
I can't remember what the exact number was, but it was
funny. The Big Ten was furthest.
Yes.
The Big Ten was like 16 to 17 points.
Yes.
And they were talking in the Big Ten meetings last week, and I meant to write a story on this and did not, but they were talking about how do we got to get that down.
Yeah.
And obviously, you get that down by all the
you get that down by Rutgers buying some better players.
Exactly. Paying more.
Yeah.
And having more of a probably a harder cap.
Yeah, that's why the Big Ten's talking like Major League Baseball, like, hey, we got to get the Pirates to spend some money here.
Yeah.
Like it's the SEC does not have that problem. The bottom of the SEC spends pretty liberally, and I remember at ACC meetings talking with a coach who said, hey, we're in the middle of our league, but we're probably on par with Mississippi State, which would fall
yeah.
near the bottom of the SEC.
The bottom, yeah, probably 14th or 15th, yeah,
and that's where their coach's argument that it's a grind and all that stuff comes from. That's where the draft numbers come from. But I think it also does enhance the TV product because you're getting more yeah. competitive games.
Yeah.
So,
well, that also gets back to the, you know, touch all the pieces we've mentioned
yeah.
on the pod, the collective bargaining piece. I think the SEC's pooling their numbers, what the figures look like, what they basically, the SEC office has asked the leagues, hey, give us what you spent on your rosters and give us what you think you'll spend next year yeah. and the next year. I think they're trying to get it. They're trying to get
that number. Yeah, that number is.
Year.
And that's something, you know, maybe Tuesday or next, you know, Thursday next week, we talk about that. Because
yeah.
The push for transparency in roster spending
right.
is
right.
really interesting. And I've talked to quite a few people about it. We've heard some people talk about it this week. That part, I think if they can get that figured out, may change the marketplace
yeah.
quite a bit. May save them some
yeah.
money
yeah.
without having to change any rules.
Yeah, and I think they're pooling some of these numbers to one as part of the collective bargaining, like, hey, just in case you want to know, yeah. here are the numbers if we start bargaining.
Yeah.
And then also, but there are changes coming at some point for the College Sports Commission. And I think the thought is if we're going to raise the cap, mm-hmm. put in a luxury tax, whatever, what does that mean numbers-wise? So I think everybody wants to get a grasp.
One thing I ask as a simple, humble college football reporter. If you do luxury tax, don't do the apron thing like the NBA does. I don't understand that. I'm not smart enough to understand that. So just make it simple, please. That's all I ask. Well, We got to go talk to some presidents and ADs. But we will get back to you on Tuesday with even more, because college football never stops, not even in the halls of Congress. We'll talk to you then.